I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Pulitzer-winning playwright and screenwriter David Mamet. He's joined in conversation by Michael Krasny. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces David Mamet and Michael Krasny.
David Mamet is here. He's an award-winning playwright, screenwriter, director, and author. His brand of edgy, rapid-fire, profanity-laced dialogue has entered the lexicon as Mamet Speak. He's best known for his Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Glengarry Glen Ross, and his Oscar-nominated movies such as Wag the Dog and The Untouchables. Mr. Mamet is here this evening to talk about his latest work, Chicago. His first novel in two decades, Chicago is set in the Windy City of the 1920s, where the mob rules, the market for sin is thriving, and the dialogue is as distinctive as ever. Appearing with David Mamet this evening is Michael Krasny, scholar, author, and award-winning broadcast journalist. Let's give them both a warm welcome to the JCC. Thank you.
Thank you for the introduction, and thank you all for being here. It's a pleasure to be back with David Mamet, and I say back because we've been on the air together a couple of times, we've been on stage a couple of times, and it's always a real pleasure and a privilege for me to be interviewing him. As was mentioned, he has a new novel out, and it is the first novel in a couple of decades, and I thought maybe we'd begin this conversation by talking about why a novel and why this particular period of time. We're talking about Prohibition, and right after the First World War, you're going back to your roots a little bit with the underworld from the days of Capone and the like. But certainly, you've been identified to a great extent with movie scripts, with playwriting, with all kinds of literature and other genres other than the novel. Why the novel for this book?
It occurred to me, thank you all for coming, by the way. It occurred to me a long time ago that I would be foolish not to have adopted a bunch of pseudonyms, because I write much too much for anyone except myself to appreciate all of it. So I thought a long time ago I should have adopted pseudonyms, because there was a fellow who, in fact, I just found one of his books at a flea market yesterday, who wrote The Hardy Boys, Ellen Drew, Tom Swift, The Rover Boy. He wrote every series from the end of the Edwardian period until World War II under different names. He wrote a book every day. And so I write every day, too. And sometimes it takes 20 years for it to become something, and sometimes it becomes something immediately. But the beavers, as we know, are driven mad by the sound of running water. So they chop down trees to stop the itching in their teeth. And then they look at the trees and say, what the hell shall I do with this? Oh, I get it. I don't like the running water. I'll stop it. So that's why they build dams. So you know, similarly, right? Well, in fact, much too similarly, being a crazy Jew, you know, without that, you know, although I might have a, you know, a TJ.
So wait a minute, you're comparing yourself to a beaver, though.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So how do you get the sound of running water to stop, right? Kind of don't do it with my teeth, but I write stuff down. So some it piles up, so there's all these piles of a play here a play, there a play, everywhere, play, right? And I do a lot of cartooning, I do a lot of joke writing, and sometimes I, in the midst of hating myself for being unproductive, I'll pick up something and say, what the hell is this? Oh, maybe I'll work on that for a while. And I think that's what happened with this book.
Well, you once said that a novel is something that is kind of content that has to find form. I think you were quoted as saying, this is a passage that I happened to read where you said you were talking about different genres distinctly. You were saying a play is poetry with different voices. I recall this. It was, my memory is still working. And the novel was described more, characterized as form finding its content or content finding the right form. But in this novel, you're so immersed in this particular era, for one thing. I mean, a lot of the detail, as just a reader, I came across Fatima cigarettes and Sheikh of Araby and first woman who was executed at Sing Sing, Burma Shave, all of these kinds of details that really put us there. And I thought, you must have done some research through this beaver collecting in terms of really trying to recreate detail of the era, didn't you?
No, I never do any. I read like mad. I read all the time, and I love novels. And I've never been able to read short stories. I mean, there's some great ones, and I appreciate them. But there's something about the periodicity of them. You know, it's a half hour, you're done. You say, wait a second. So the bigger, the longer the novel is, the more I love it. And so I read novels all the time. I love reading novels. And so your question was about... Oh, yeah. So similarly to the... there's something in human consciousness that was, as of course, as we all know, approached a little bit by Rudolf Arnheim in Film as Art, where he's talking about the 50-millimeter lens being the closest that the photographic form comes to the way the eye sees. So I thought the closest to my understanding the way the world works is in this incredible jumble of narrative and plot, what's called a novel. And I think a lot about form because I write a lot of drama, and it seems to me that the dramatic form about a two-hour play corresponds to something in human consciousness, a long after-dinner discussion. Right, the time between dinner and bedtime, the story around the campfire, the movie, the play is all 2 hours, about 2 hours, and the after dinner speech, a good one, is certainly no longer than about 25 minutes, which is the time of a half hour episode of TV, a comedy episode of TV, and it used to be the dramatic episode of TV. It's kind of pleasing. But the hour form of TV, and I did a lot of it, is basically impossible because it corresponds to nothing in human experience. So it has to be... It takes a lot of forcing. But a novel, both in reading and in writing, you can expatiate. You can say, oh, my God, this is interesting. Let me write about Father Zosima, you know, or all them other commies, you know, and Dostoevsky's.
In many ways, a much freer form. I mean, you've got a larger canvas to work on, basically.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun because it's great fun writing a drama, but it's extraordinarily exacting, you know. So you have the great exuberance of, you know, like a love affair with the idea. And then you, as Paul Simon once said to me one day, he said, it's in my head, or are they really going to make me write it down?
Yeah. Well, our two main characters in this novel, Mike and Paltrow, are essentially hard-nosed journalists, reporters, and kind of cynics, philosophers, really, in many ways. I just wondered, you know, like in Glengarry Glen Ross, there was a sense of people would say, boy, Mamet really knows what it's like, these guys who could sell cancer, you know, if they had that as a product that they were selling. It's almost as if you're hearing voices out of the past in the newsroom of these kind of hard-boiled reporters. You're bringing them alive again. What's the genesis of that for you as a writer?
Well, I grew up in Chicago. I mean, you know, my dad was a Depression kid and grew up in Chicago, and those were the stories that I grew up with. You know, the guy who knew Al Capone, or the people who lived across the street whose actual name had been Leopold, and they changed their name because of the Leopold and Loeb case, or this guy got jammed up and went downstate. And then I ran away from home, as it were, you know, and started working in every job known to man, had a great time, and fell in with a whole bunch of thieves and con people and semi-con people and carpet salesmen and car salesmen, and I got to live in that world. So that it was fun.
These are the people who have become sort of your bread and butter in many ways for a lot of the work. I mean, bringing them to life on the stage, or bringing them to bear as you do in this novel. But a lot of people ask this question. I'm going to ask them, try to frame it in a way that's particular to your work. There's often the comparison to Harold Pinter. You know, the original kind of voices that you hear that are essentially voices trying to ascertain power or voices that have a whole subtext to them, or in your case, more of an idiom. I mean, people think, where did Mamet get that ear? Is it from, you know, the world of Chicago for the most part? That's the roots of it? The way people talk, the rhythm of the way people talk, particularly outlaws and lowlives and proletarian people?
Well, I'm doing two things. I'm listening to them, then I'm making it up. Because the great contribution of Pinter to drama, which really comes to a large extent out of his reverence for Beckett, is the reinvention of drama as poetry rather than as rational or naturalistic drama. So that's what Pinter did. He was a great poet.
Mm-hmm. In many ways, you aspire to poetry, especially in your early drama, don't you?
Yeah, and I was thinking today about April, right? And, of course, about T.S. Eliot, right? He says, April is the cruelest month, right? And T.S. Eliot was very, very important to me in high school because I learned in an English class, not from the teacher, one of the students, the most important thing about T.S. Eliot was if you take the S out of his name and spell it backwards, it spells toilet. So, and that's true. And so I was thinking, you know, the actual line is, April is the cruelest month breeding lilacs out of the dead land. I said, yeah, okay. But if I could go back and I'd say, T.S., you know, jazz it up a little bit. What about this? April is the cruelest month. Doo-da, doo-da.
Yeah. Or cha-cha-cha. So I imagine you, from what I know about you, as someone who didn't spend that much time in the world of academia or studying literature in a formal way, the way that, say, I was given to teaching someone like T.S. Eliot low these many years. In fact, you kind of got your education outside of the classroom, not only in terms of the streets, but in libraries and books that you would simply take in and absorb. You know?
Well, yeah, I applied to all these universities, but it didn't take me, and they were quite right, because I never opened a school book in my life. But then I went to this hippy-dippy school where they and kind of majored in poker and ping-pong and sex and drugs, and so I never opened a school book in my life there, too. But I later had a great experience of academia, teaching as an adjunct professor or a visiting scholar or blah, blah, at the great universities of this country. And I was gratified to find they was as completely full of shit as anything I'd ever found in my life, but not as interesting as the people that I met on the south side of Chicago.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the people in this novel. Particularly one of the most fascinating characters, and you've probably heard this by many who have read the novel, is Peekaboo.
Yeah, it is, yeah, the character of Peekaboo, I love that character. The character of Peekaboo is this woman. She's a madam of a black whorehouse. She's a black woman, madam of a black whorehouse in Chicago on the stroll.
Called Ace of Spades.
Ace of Spades. Yeah. So the stroll was the Black Broadway, the south side of Chicago. I think it was State Street between 32nd and 34th Street. And just like one of the characters in the book, the white characters, he says he would do anything to be a part of that life, but he can't because he's white. And I would do anything to be a part of that life because it's gone, I'm white, and it's never coming back again. But there's a character in the whorehouse who's the old piano player. His old black man is sitting over there, you know, drinking his bourbon and smoking his cigar, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and he's batting out the blues. And I always thought that was how I was going to end my life. Right, being a piano player in a whorehouse, and I always kind of looked forward to it. But
well, she comes across also as someone who embodies a certain modicum of wisdom, which I really like.
Well, thank you. Well, she is the wisdom character, yeah. Or as Alex Haley would have said, the griot, or you know, or as Molière would have said, the raisonneuse of the piece. She's the person who's the repository of all wisdom, and whom the main character of the book, Mike Hodges, goes to for solace and understanding when his life falls apart.
Yeah, let's talk about Mike, because, I mean, there's a couple of murder mysteries going on in here, but there's also a love affair, and he falls madly in love with a young Irish girl by the name of Annie Walsh, and I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but this is actually one of the things that would probably make people buy the book, the fact that he thinks somebody's after him, but they wind up shooting her to death. And thus we have one of the main trajectories of plot in the story. Why was she murdered? Why was he not murdered? And so forth. But his loss and the grieving that he goes through. I mean, he literally tries to drink himself to death, and he's become suicidal. And I'm just wondering to what extent, you know, that follows a certain kind of, I don't know if you've ever dealt with that kind of depression before.
Well, sure. You know, I mean, I was very fortunate to study for many years with the great Rabbi Larry Kushner, who once said, I've never been able to spend more than half an hour with anybody whose life hadn't gone completely to pieces at one time. So, differently, you can't sing the blues if you ain't had the blues.
Well, there's this old saying about with plots, you can get your character up a tree and then you got to get him out. And you kind of did that with Mike in terms of his depression, really.
Well, that's the problem with the plot. I mean, the old theatrical wisdom is anybody could write a first act. The question is, what do I do now?
Yeah. And all these pieces just came together through the years, including the whole trajectory of the murder mystery, the romance, and so forth?
Well, you got to write it. You know, Anthony Trollope once said, some young actor, writer said, what's the most important thing a writer should have? And he says, some cobbler's wax. He said, put it on top of your seat.
Mm-hmm. That's actually a perfect metaphor in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's an Isaac Bashevis Singer story about cobbling, and he's really talking about writing, I think, in disguise in some ways. You mentioned Rabbi Kushner. Let me ask you something about the way that ethnicities play a role in this new novel of yours. You've got a remark made about the Irish who love to fight and the Italians who stay generations with grudges. And then there are the Jews. And the Jews seem to play a particularly specific role in some ways in this novel, as they do in a lot of your work. Now, I know that you have a great deal of a strong identity as being a Jew. You even wrote a book on the Talmud, I think, and you wrote a book on...
Well, Rabbi Kushner and I wrote a commentary on the Chumash.
And did you also write a book about Leo, a novel about Leo Frank, the Jew?
Yeah, I wrote a novel about Leo
lynched
Frank.
Lynched in Georgia for... Yeah. Yeah, actually lynched.
And I wrote a book that really got me in the soup called The Wicked Son, Anti-Semitism, Self-Loathing in the Jews. It's a page-turner and a laugh riot.
He also, David is also a skilled Jewish joke teller, and, you know, I'm speaking as the source of someone who's...
Thank you. But I have to quote what the Christian Science Monitor said about the book. It said, not enough pictures.
Well, how do you see the different ethnicities, though, especially being a Chicago boy? Because, you know, I was thinking back, even in a play like some of your early work, thinking about Levine in Glengarry Glen Ross, or even Teach talks about the Holocaust and American Buffalo. And here we've got Weiss and Teitelbaum, and they're pretty wicked characters. Just want to get you to sort of lay out how you see the ethnicities and how they operate in your mind.
Well, I mean, Weiss and Teitelbaum, the character, are two Jewish gangsters, you know, and I knew a lot of them when I was coming up, because the Jews is every immigrant wave. One of the original things they went into was crime, and there was still a lot of that residue in Chicago when I was growing up. The Purple Gang, when you were growing up, of those guys who were the criminals. And I grew up knowing a lot of those guys on the outskirts. You know, the used car salesmen and the crooked land dealers and the pawnbrokers and so forth. And that was the era that I grew up in. And so as I went out into the world and I started to hear the then contemporary and since worsened Jewish mantra of basically Jewish assimilation and passivity and weakness, I found it shocking because I didn't know any weak Jews, right? Well, the only Jews I knew were strong Jews. They had to be. You know, they came from Eastern Europe and they grew up in the Depression. Everybody hated them. And yet they had to make a living. And those were the Jews that I knew.
Is it true that you're writing a script now about Harvey Weinstein?
Well, let me put it this way, yes. It's not really about Harvey Weinstein. It's about a guy of a similar name in a similar situation.
What about that situation? You want to comment on it? I mean, the whole Me Too movement and so forth. I recently interviewed Sean Penn, and he was rather pejorative in his remarks about the Me Too movement. He said, I'm tired of movements, even though he likes the idea of young people bringing gun control or at least some kind of reckoning with the gun problems that we have.
No, I think gun control is a spectacular thing for people to get involved in, because somebody breaks into your house, you should definitely give them a leaflet. Yeah, but there may be many things in life which are...
That's an empirically proven statement, right?
There may be a lot of things in life which are not sexual politics, but I have yet to find any of them.
Did you want to say something about this so-called conversion that many have ballyhooed about? David Mamet is now a conservative and wasn't before or whatever?
No.
Okay.
You're listening to playwright and screenwriter David Mamet, whose new novel is Chicago. He's joined in conversation by Michael Krasny on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Let me get back, though, to the characters, the ethnic characters. You got Jay Guzik doing kind of a cameo walk-on in here, who is Capone's, one of his henchmen and his accountant. And I wondered, the idea that, and we associate it mostly with somebody like Doctorow, of putting actual historical figures in. You didn't do a lot of that here, but there's some of it here in this novel.
Well, there's a little bit of it. Alfred Hitchcock, right, a famous Jewish director, once said, if you're going to make a movie about Paris, for God's sake, show him the Eiffel Tower. So we were talking about Alcatraz. You know, if you're going to make a movie about San Francisco, you better show him a cable car or Alcatraz. So I thought, well, you know, wise up. If you're going to make a book about the Al Capone era, why not put in Al Capone? Mm-hmm. But I heard a great story the guy told me about Jake Guzik, and he swore it was true, that they were auctioning off the Aliyot on Yom Kippur, which is I don't know if they do that anymore. They do it in Europe. I've seen it, but they don't. It was an old deal where they would say how much for the first Aliyah, how much for the second Aliyah, and then people would buy the Aliyahs, right? The ability to come up to the Bima and bless the Torah, and then they would award it to someone else. So it was a great way to pass on favor and a great way to raise money for the shul. So auctioning off the first Aliyah on Yom Kippur, and one guy says $100, $200, blah blah blah, and Jake Guzik stands up, and he lets his coat fall open. He's got 2 45 automatics. He says $1,000, and I'm coming up. I thought, well, God bless you, Jake.
Well, there's a lot of, as one might expect with some of your work, a lot of gangsterism here. And I was, I don't know, maybe surprised and in many ways fascinated by some of the things that you wove into the... I mean, the IRA, for example, comes into this story.
Yeah.
Were you exposed at all in Chicago to IRA?
No, I wasn't exposed to the IRA, but I was very much exposed as it became clear to me as I grew older to the operations of people pre-statehood in Chicago and in Cleveland, in the Haganah and the Irgun, helping out the fight for Israeli independence. You know, and Shlomo, the carpet dealer, who was actually a gun runner, and Vidal Sassoon, who actually went to fight, and Hank Greenberg, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's another reason I found rather incomprehensible the notion of weak Jews.
So you didn't go into a study mode about like O'Bannon and Capone. You picked all this up pretty much by osmosis growing up in Chicago, really.
Yeah, you grow up with that. That's the history of Chicago. Yeah. You know, where the Metropole Hotel and Marshall Field's son getting shot in a whorehouse, and there's where they ground down Dion O'Banion, and there's where they shot Jake Morton and his horse, and because the horse threw him in Central Park, so they machine gun the horse to death. And I went to high school. The place was across the street from where the St. Valentine's Day massacre had taken place. And so they always said, oh, you know, the kids in those days actually heard the shots. Who knew? But that's the history of Chicago.
You heard a lot growing up about Leopold and Loeb, too, I presume, because they come into the novel, too.
Well, Leopold and Loeb were these two psychopathic kids, and very, very wealthy Jewish kids in Chicago. In 1925, they were arrested for murder, kidnapping, brutalizing, disfiguring, and killing one of their school chums, another wealthy young Jewish kid. And it was the crime of the century.
The kid's name was Bobby Frank, yeah.
And when I was a kid, we first lived in Hyde Park, right down around the corner from what had been the Franks Mansion. I mean, it was all cut up into flats. And my dad used to say, be careful, because you know what happened to Bobby Franks. So,
And I don't want to give away anything, as I said, but you have a kind of different interpretation, especially about Clarence Darrow's role in the murders and the bringing to justice of...
Well, Clarence Darrow was hired to defend Leopold and Loeb, who were just stone guilty. And had he gone to trial and pleaded them not guilty, they would have been executed. And he couldn't plead them guilty because if he pled them guilty, he would have to say not guilty by reason of insanity, and the head shrinkers would have come in. He probably would have said, no, he's good enough, they're good enough to stand trial. So he cobbled together this phony baloney thing, not guilty with extenuating circumstances. And the extenuating circumstances were they're nuts, but they aren't that nuts. So there were two questions in my mind, one of which is why the judge would have accepted that plea, because the prosecution legitimately screamed bloody murder and foul. They said, if you're saying not guilty by reason of insanity, we got to impanel a jury, right? And if you're saying guilty, sentence him to death. Go ahead. And so I was reading a book by Adela Rogers St. John, who was one of the first female screenwriters and a gossip columnist and a crime writer for Hearst. And she was... her dad was a guy called Earl Rogers, who was I believe a San Franciscan, and was the contemporary of Darrow, and in fact defended Darrow when Darrow was accused correctly of bribing the jury in the bombing of the L.A. Times, whatever the hell year that was. And so she writes a lot about Darrow, and she says Darrow was known as the champion of lost causes and lost cases, and he unabashedly bribed people because he said that's what the government's doing, that's what I should do. So anyway, one of the people involved in the case, the Leopold and Loeb case, was a young man named Elmer Gertz, who was a contemporary of Leopold and Loeb, who was at school with them. Curiously, in the same class were Will Geer. Remember Will Geer? No, he was a wonderful actor. I guess he was famous at the end of his life. He was on The Waltons. And another one was Meyer Levin, who eventually wrote the book Compulsion. Anyway, my dad got out of law school after the war and went to work for Elmer Gertz. And I was talking to Elmer Gertz a few years ago in his late 90s, and I said, Elmer, who was very close to the case, and actually when Nathan Leopold got out of prison, Nathan Leopold sued Meyer Levin, who wrote the book. Listen, I know this goes on forever, but you're going to be gratified to know that the punchline is not any more interesting. Okay, so Nathan Leopold serves 33 years in prison. He gets up. Meyer Levin writes a book about the Leopold and Loeb case called Compulsion. And Nathan Leopold sued him, and Elmer Gertz defended him. So Elmer Gertz was very okerong with the whole story. So I was talking on the phone with Elmer. I said, there's two things that puzzle me about the Leopold and Loeb trial. One, why did the judge accept the phony baloney plea? And two, why did the families refuse to pay Darrow? Because they stiffed him on the fee. Eventually, they settled for a fraction of what they just wouldn't pay him. So he starts to laugh. He says, you want to know the whole story? I said, yeah. I said, the whole story was Darrow said, give me $100,000. I'll give it to the judge, and he'll sentence them to Switzerland. And they'll say, they're upset. And they'll go spend 5 years in a sanatorium playing shuffleboard, and they'll come home. So they give him $100,000, but he stiffs the judge, right? He gives the judge like $10,000. He says, that's as high as they'd go, right? And so the judge sentences them to life plus 99 years. And that was the story that explained both things.
Which you bring in really sort of toward the end of the novel, and I thought in some ways this was just a kind of capstone about the corruption and bribery that is so identified with the title of your book, Chicago.
Well, it's all over. It's not Chicago. I mean, it's not Chicago, and it's not democracy. It's the human condition.
Why is it that people always, I mean, the jokes about Chicago, even when Barack Obama had political ties there, all of the governors of Illinois who have wound up in a penitentiary. I mean, the jokes are legion, and the jokes, I think, are very revelatory of the fact that Chicago is identified. Daley's fixing of the, supposedly, or trying to fix the Kennedy inauguration presidency. I mean, there's so much that is associated with Chicago and corruption, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. That's true.
And I'm actually, when you mentioned your father, I was inclined to ask you, your father was a labor lawyer, so he probably came in contact with, I presume, maybe a little, not Hoffa, he might have known Hoffa, I don't know, but a lot of those kind of characters or those thugs, didn't he?
That's completely possible. And in fact, when I was writing Hoffa, I went to my dad, he knew Hoffa, and he said at one point the Teamsters came to him, and he said he turned him down. He said, I can't do that. But I grew up, I mean, the people who were in my dad's offices, he represented the motion picture cameramen, the electrical workers, the hod carriers, right? So everybody I grew up around was saying these, them, and those the whole time, you know, just like me. They were actually working people. And so Chicago's always been a working person's town, and my dad used to say, New York's the biggest hick town in the world, which is true. And Chicago was all these, them, and those, and who do you have to know around here to fix a parking ticket, right? Which is, of course, the way that, as I understand it, the world works, is that some of us award ourselves credit for not noticing.
But even when you go back, and I do sometimes, to Carl Sandburg's poem about Chicago, it's... You still got, you know, prostitutes and thugs and bad people and so forth, corruption as kind of a hallmark. And yet, well, actually, let me get you to comment on, because there's a great tradition of novel writing in Chicago. It goes all the way back to Dreiser and really forward to figures like Nelson Algren, Sal Bellow, Richard Wright. I mean, but it's a kind of a harsh, often grim realism that's associated.
Well, yeah, because the...
James C. Farrell, yeah?
Yeah, sure. And... The Chicago literary tradition, which is really, forgive me, the history of mid-20th century American literature is all Chicagoan. It comes out of journalism, right? I mean, Dreiser was a journalist. You know, Hemingway wrote like a journalist. It comes out of the tradition of tell the story and get on with it. You know, I went back and I reread a couple of weeks ago two books that drove me crazy in high school. And one of them was The Great Gatsby, and the other one was The Catcher in the Rye. And everybody had to read them in high school in those days. Maybe they still do. They aren't very good. You know, they're written is what they are.
Talking about the two most lionized probably works of American
literature.
Yeah,
but go, I mean, you know... Big deal. You know, I prefer my bourbon straight, you know. If I want a pink lady, I'll ask for it, you know.
You know what H.L. Mencken said about The Great Gatsby? It's an anecdote.
Oh, good for him. Yeah. Good for him. Yeah, he's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. I mean, compare it to, you know, you mentioned, I mean, there's a couple of good writers who came out of New York in that period, namely Edith Wharton. But, I mean, go read Thomas Wolfe, for Christ's sake. Oh, you know, who cares? But if you read, there's Dreiser and Willa Cather, and you mentioned Richard Wright and Nella Larson and Knock on Any Door. Come on, who wrote Knock on Any Door? Walt, what? No, it's going to come to me in a second. No, let no man write my epitaph. Mm-hmm. And then Algren came in a little bit later on. But they're all very, very rough. And most important to me, really, as a dramatist, was The Front Page, which I think is the best American play, was written by two drunk newspaper men, right? Hecht and MacArthur. Yeah. And Ben Hecht, who I believe worked for the Daily News, wrote a column called The... It was originally gathered as 1001 Afternoons in Chicago, and it's the most magnificent 700 words every day for 3 years you ever read in your life. Check it out, 1001 Afternoons in Chicago. And he was, of course, even preceded by Philly Peter Dunn and Mr. Dooley, you know, which is Irish bartender. It's just such great, harsh stuff. And I was, as I said, I was talking to Scott Simon and then he sent me several books. He's a spectacular novelist. And one of his books is about the Chicago City Council. It's a novel, a fairly hysterically funny novel about the Chicago City Council. He rips it to shreds. And his grandfather was a cop. It's so essentially Chicago. You know, there's nothing writerly about it.
Well, there's also this link that you're intimating, which I think is real, between journalists... and novelists. And in fact, your two main characters are pretty literary guys. I mean, you know, they're no slouches when it comes to not only their insights and their wisdom in general, but their literary sense.
Well, you know, I as a proud and pompous autodidact, my close friends have always been people like me who have devoured anything to read they could get their hands on. And if you mention something they hadn't read, will have read all of it by the next time. So that gives you a fairly wide vocabulary and a fairly wide acquaintanceship with human thought, which you ain't going to get at college.
Mm-hmm. Although there's some instances in your novel about news that's being reported that, again, ties in with corruption or news that, I guess we call it fake news by today's standards, and these reporters try to get behind the mystery, and they try to get certainly solving many of the things that occur, particularly some of the brutal things that occur, but they're right up there, close to it and everything. Journalism's changed in ways. I'd like to get you to comment on that, just in the sense of what reporters do, like used to do for the Tribune, like Mike and his partner, and what they do today.
Yeah, well, I think the only thing wrong with print journalism today is it's all over.
Said, yeah.
You know, Thomas Jefferson said, given a choice of a newspapers without a government and a government without newspapers, I would rather have newspapers without a government, and now we don't have either one of them.
And yet there are those who continue to say, thank heavens for the Fourth Estate, particularly today, in terms of, well, what they see is a lot of the prevaricating that's coming out of Washington and so forth.
Well, when has it ever been different?
That's, I think, a very telling and trenchant question. Has it ever been different?
I don't think so. I think that what we're talking about is the human condition. That anyone, you know, you've done publicity, mind both sides, right?
Yeah.
So imagine you're in a life where, from the age of 18 to the age of 60, you're on a book tour. Right? And you're on a book tour 14 hours a day, 7 days a week for 50 years. And your job is to smile at people for whom you can have nothing but contempt.
What about your in general, let's just talk about your work for the theater. What continues to give you the most pride or happiness in terms of the plays that you've given to the world?
Well, you know, I often said in a charmingly but indictable fit of self-congratulation that I'm basically a gag writer, because writing for the theater is really it's writing jokes. That's all it's doing. One joke follows another, and one joke follows another. Just like you don't want to overload the punchline, you don't want to give more information in the punchline than is needed to understand the punchline.
Yeah.
The punchline has got to pay off the joke. So you say, I get it. Now I understood something that I didn't understand before. I was willing to suspend my... anybody hear the suspension of disbelief? Remember that? We grew up with that. People talk about...
It's Coleridge.
What?
It's Coleridge.
Yeah. Is it?
I mean,
whatever
it
is,
yeah.
Here's how you can understand it. Two walruses go into a bar, right? So we hear, you're suspending your disbelief. Two walruses go into a bar and you say, yeah. That means tell me, oh, here's a joke you're going to like. I made it up. Ready? I used to write a lot of jokes. Okay, any Jews in the audience? Right. So these two manatees, okay? These two manatees, they go up to their rabbi. They say, Rabbi, we have... a couple of ideas about a different way to say the Kaddish, right? Rabbi says, dugongs don't make a right. Thank you, sir. So, a joke is, you're going to give me a premise, and I'm going to accept it, expecting that you're going to give me a reward at the end, that you're going to pay off the premise in a way that I didn't expect, right? My son says, my son is a great humorist, right? He said, Dad, tell me one of the old jokes when you were a kid. I say, okay. Two guys, one guy says, the invisible man is here. The other guy says, tell him I can't see him. So my son calls me back the next day. He says, I've improved on the joke. I say, good, let's hear it. He says, okay, two guys. One guy says, the invisible man is here. The other guy says, tell him to go. So that's all a drama is a succession of interchanges that logically lead one to the next, each containing both the setup for which we suspend our disbelief and a punchline which becomes the setup for the successive interchange, right? They build up into a scene that concludes in a surprising yet inevitable way, making you say, yes, I've heard enough so far, but you left me with sufficiently provoked to want to find out what happens in the next scene, and do one scene after the next, and you end up with a play.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features playwright and screenwriter David Mamet, whose new novel is Chicago. He's joined in conversation by Michael Krasny. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So I know you're teaching writing online now. You've got a little enterprise going. Is this a kind of paradigm or pattern, you know, you start out with, I mean, because it can apply to any genre, and you've worked in all the genres, you start out with a commitment and you set up in such a way that you there's a payoff, there's a...
No, this is, what I'm talking about is, it has to do with specifically with drama. I mean, it helps to, you know, as it helps to be able to write good, but drama requires you to be able to write well, and it requires you to have a complete understanding of plot, which can only be gained from the audience. So that's why it's so difficult for people to learn how to write, because something may make a lot of sense to you, but until you put it into an audience, you're not going to learn whether it works or not. And until you get humiliated by your failures, you aren't going to have sufficient drive to get over one's own inevitable egoistic love of one's own creation and say, geez, I thought it worked, but it doesn't. I better figure this out.
You believe in these old classic notions, you know, like Aristotle in the Poetics, you got to arouse fear, you have to arouse, or terror, you have to arouse pity, those kinds of emotions particularly, especially if you're working in tragedy?
Well, yeah. I mean, he wrote a very good book, really one of the only two books written, good books about a dramatic structure, the Poetics. And what he's saying at the end is not that you have to arouse fear and pity, but that the audience should be left with fear and pity. Or to say, I followed this all the way through. The guy was doing exactly the right thing, but he ended up ruining himself and everyone he ever touched. Poor guy. Right, pity, and oh my God, I guess I'm flawed too. So that's the purpose of drama. Going back to religion is to free us from a belief in our own rationality and our own goodness, which can't be done rationally. And that's where Freud got it wrong, right? You really can't use the mind to fix the mind because it's all the Yetzer Hara, right? You can do it through celebration. And so at some point, people substituted infant sacrifice, and they came up with drama. And from then, they reverted to the sacrifice of the young, which we call the university system.
Well, when you mentioned before how Beckett changed the theater and how Pinter changed the theater, I think you've changed the theater, too. You've made your mark, to put it mildly, understatement. But the reality is that we have a kind of different mode of theater, and yours is a good example of that. Some of your theater, it's more what could be described, and this is true about Beckett too, seriocomic. I mean, there's a lot of humor in a lot of your drama. There's a lot of drama too, obviously, but you like to mix them, and is it in some ways harder to bring in the comedic elements sometimes, or is it more of a challenge?
I don't know. I mean, I was thinking about Middle Eastern music, right? And Irving Berlin, right? He's very much a Jewish composer. And and so the question is, what is there in Middle Eastern music and that's distinctive? What is there in Jewish music, in Ashkenazi music that's distinctive? And what there's distinctive is it's the constant modulation between the major and the minor. That's what you have. And so at one point I was thinking, let me stretch my knowledge into a theory beyond its capacity. And I thought maybe that had to do with working with the wind instruments, because it's easier to bend a note. But in any case, Jewish humor, you know, we laugh because it's tragic and we cry because it's funny. And Mel Brooks said, what's the difference between a comedian and a regular person? He says a regular person will laugh at a comedian dressed up like a little old lady falling downstairs, but if you're a comedian, it has to be a real little old lady.
You still stay in touch with and connected to that repertory of actors that you work with so many times as both director and playwright through the years? I'm talking about people like William H. Macy and so forth.
Yeah, sure. We talk to each other. You know, we went off on our different ways and our different careers, but we get together and we work together when we can. I know we all feel very, very fortunate to have been together in Chicago and New York for a good 20 years off and on before our various careers took us off in different directions. So that now, you know, if I call up Billy Macy or Felicity Huffman or Joe Mantegna or whomever, they got commitments that stretch off into the future, as do I. So the odds of us getting together on of the music of the spheres ending up at on adjacent bar stools are less and less.
What about acting? Has it ever appealed to you?
No, I can't act. I said to Macy once, I was at a party saying, I said, I'd be the first person to tell you that I can't act. He said, no, you'd be the second person. But I always loved acting. I loved being around actors. And if you look at people like Stanislavski and people also like Sanford Meisner and Lee Strasberg and Bobby Lewis and Michael Chekhov, and all that, there are all these people who've theorize about what acting is, and they never figure it out, because you really can't, because they're so drawn to it, they want to be close to it, and they can't do it, right? The great actors, very few of them that I know, Michael Redgrave may be an exception, seldom wrote a theoretical books about acting.
You remember one of the first interviews we did was when you did this book on Stanislavski. I mean, how do you look at acting method now, or for that matter, theory about acting at this juncture?
Yeah, I've been working with actors professionally for about 50 years, and what it comes down to is, as Jimmy Cagney said, hit your mark, look the other fellow in the eye, and tell the truth. That's it. The things that a young actor could learn are the only things they're not going to teach them in acting schools. Stand up, stand still, speak the line clearly. That's it. The rest is with the gods, and the great skills of the actor come out of basically not out of their inventiveness, because it's the last thing you want an actor to be. It's the playwright's job to be inventive. What you need the actor to be is to be courageous.
When I think of your plays, I think of certain actors who have really distinguished themselves, though, who become identified with your dramaturgy. I think of someone like Mantegna, for example, Joe Mantegna. There is a certain kind of actor that you work better with. Can you characterize what that is? Or is there a kind of secret sauce or ingredients or something along those
lines? No, I don't know if there's any actors that I'm better or worse with. I mean, I tend to get along with all actors because, having listened to a lot of nonsense direction in my life, I'm never going to ask an actor to do anything that's impossible, like feel something more deeply or use the space or remember in Act 3 you say something like this or tell me where the... This is all nonsense. None of it makes any difference. And so I always say that the best thing that any director could do in a rehearsal process is to stay home.
Well, I probably mentioned Joe Mantegna because I recently saw House of Games again, and I made the connection, and I wonder if this seems appropriate in your mind, between the way con artists operate and the way actors operate. I mean, in a sense, they're both creating a false persona, and they both have to stand behind that false persona, make it utterly credible.
Yeah, except I think there's a lot in what you say, except the actor's not creating a false persona. What the actor's doing is living out a fantasy, yeah, as truthfully as possible. And that's what makes the great actor. Can you teach it? No. Can you learn it? You have to. It's one of those things that has to be learned and can't be taught. And there again, though, you can't learn it in a school. Why? Because the audio, it's a corrupt interchange. You're paying people to put you in theater camp in front of an audience which is not paid its admission. Because when the audience pays its admission, they have an absolute right, an unappealable right to be diverted. And if you can't do them in the real world, you're out of a job.
You say you can't teach it. Wasn't Strasberg trying to teach it, though? Wasn't that what he was all about?
Strasberg was completely full of it. And, you know, I know I worked with all of those people who studied with Strasberg. You know, I worked with Gene Hackman. I worked with Robert Duvall, was more from the Playhouse. I worked with Al Pacino. Worked with Bobby De Niro. And what Strasberg did, although he didn't know he was doing it, is he had a great auditioning process. He said, okay, you, the best actors in Topeka and Des Moines and Niceville, Florida, come to New York and audition for me, and we'll wean you down and wean you down and wean you down and pick the best actors in the country. He didn't teach them anything.
Which also prompts me to ask you, since you're teaching writing online now, what about the idea that writing is a talent, that it can't necessarily be taught?
Well, it can be taught, and one of the great ways to learn writing is through reading, and the other one is to get a job. For example, you know, I think my first paying job was writing sports for the Park Forest Star. I think it was about 13. Because if you got a good editor, the editor is not going to say, be more feeling. They're going to say, I don't get it, or take this word out. And so someone opined that one of the great inspirations of Hemingway, I don't think it's true, but it's cute, was the telegraph, because every word cost you something.
They call it cablese. You know, he'd send the cables from being abroad, and he had to get paid a certain number of words. It had to be nominal number of words.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about your movies earlier this evening coming over here, and I was thinking about The Range. Now, what I wonder about that is, especially for original screenplays, but even for the ones that you adapt from another work, something have to ignite in you, because the versatility is really extraordinary. So you go from one to one, just it ignites and you follow it through, as opposed to this novel, Chicago, which maybe was a number of years in the making. Because you have to write under pressure when you're writing screenplays. You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's great to write under pressure. You know, I mean, somebody said, I might have been Arnold Bennett talking about someone, said, like all prolific writers, he was incredibly lazy. Because, I mean, that's how I always feel. You know, he's going to sit around all day and write a couple words, and, you know, you do it enough, it tends to mount up. But it reminds me of the joke about the, you know, this joke of the screenwriter and the elves? And the elves?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I got to tell a joke.
So
there's this screenwriter, you see, yeah. And so he falls on hard times, and he has a cocaine habit, and he has some bad investments, and his agent steals his money, and he goes broke, and his wife leaves him, and he's sitting all alone in his house in Malibu. He has to leave the next day, and all he has is a typewriter, his last bottle of scotch, and a pistol. So he's going to drink the bottle of scotch and blow his brains out. So he drinks the bottle of scotch, he passes out. He wakes up the next morning, and next to the typewriter is a script, fully typed script, and he reads the script, and it's the best script he's ever read. And he looks back at the title page to see whose name is on it, and it's his name. So he gives it to his agent. His agent gets him a deal. It's a big hit. Now he's on top of the world. The next year, they offer him $10 million to write another script. He still can't write. He goes back to the beach house, which he's now bought back, got the bottle of scotch, da-da-da, drinks the thing, wakes up the next morning. There's another script even better than the first. Now he's got a house in Bel Air. He's got a jet plane. So the third year, he gets the bottle of scotch, but he fills it with tea. And he drinks the tea, and he doesn't pass out. And he wakes up, and he sees these two little elves, and they're typing. And he says to the elves, my God, you've been writing these scripts. And they say, yeah. And he says, you've saved my life. I was bigger than I was before. What can I do for you? And the elves say, you can't do anything. We don't need anything. Well, you know, we're elves. It's what we do. We're just these elves. He says, oh, come on, let me do something. Please, let me attempt to discharge my debt. Is there anything you'd like? One elf says, he says, well, we'd kind of like a screen credit. He says, why don't you go f- So perhaps the reason I brought it up is I got this shelf, you know, like Mortimer Adler, the 5-foot shelf. Remember anybody go back that far? The great books, 5-foot shelf of the great books. It's just like God said, okay, you got to spin all of this flax into gold, and you got to fill up the 5-foot shelf of books, and then I'll let you die. So that's kind of what I've been trying to do. So, and I got to put my name on it.
Final question from the audience.
Yeah.
And you get this a lot, but it's still, I think, a worthy question. Is your greatest passion writing books, plays, screenplays, or directing movies? What is there a greater passion between those? Add a novel and maybe add joke telling. No, just joking.
No, my greatest passion is napping.
You know what is a great passion of yours, I believe?
What's that?
Poker.
Yeah, I haven't played poker for many, many years. It used to be a great passion. One day I just woke up and wasn't interested in it anymore.
And hunting, too, at one time, yeah?
Well, yeah, but, you know, I mean, when I lived in Vermont, I did a lot of hunting, but, I mean, now you know, I live in Santa Monica, and I said, you know, I'd like to contribute something to the city, right? And I want to build, like, a big arch over the entrance to Santa Monica. And emblazoned on the arch, I wanted to say, through these portals, past the stupidest Jews in the world. So that's what the current wildlife is where I live.
You remember Tom Lehrer's great line? I'm having Hanukkah in Santa Monica.
What's what he said? Oh, yeah. I was thinking of Tom Lehrer, who, of course, is also Jewish. Yeah. And I used to see him in Harvard Square all the time. And he said, one of his great lyrics, which, of course, you'll know, he says, "Now it's fiesta time in Akron, Ohio, but it's back to old Guadalajara. I'm longing to go far away from the strikes of the AFL and CIO." I think you got to be of a certain age to appreciate that.
Ladies and gentlemen, when you bought tickets, you had no idea you'd wind up with David Mamet singing, but let me thank him for a wonderful evening.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was playwright and screenwriter David Mamet, whose new novel is Chicago. He was joined in conversation by Michael Krasny. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalay, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.